Very interesting, and we all look forward to your December report. I want to open it up to any questions. Please say who you are and where you're from. There's a guy back there. Could we, since we're recording this, could I?
Hi, my name is Ed Estee. I'm with SRI International and WestEd and Independent. Could you say something more about this notion of prestige and respect? It occurs to me that teaching is the profession that all kids first get an idea of, because they all start off in kindergarten or first grade or whatever. They all know teachers. Teachers are something unlike engineers or mathematicians, who kids get to know, and their parents do too, through the school. Yet their teaching in this country, I think, if my impressions is right, has much less respect and prestige from the point of view of the parents than, for example, in Singapore or Korea. Is this a chicken and egg kind of thing? If we had much higher teacher salaries, would that automatically generate more respect and honor among parents and other adults in the community, and thus lead to more kids right from the beginning wanting to become teachers?
I think it's in part an issue not just of salaries, but of working conditions. The students, the young people that you talk to and say, why didn't you choose teaching? They say, because I see what my teacher has to put up with. It's not the salary that worries them quite as much, though that is definitely a factor for young people coming out of school. And if the private sector is offering them 50 and the public sector is offering them 35, that's a pretty big difference. Plus, the jumps are quite different on our current salary schedule, minuscule as opposed to the big ones. But I think the issue of respect is an issue that, again, is reverberating across the world. Teachers are not as respected in any of these countries as they once were. And while in Japan the salaries are still commensurate, by the time you get to the 15-year salary, they start low. Korea starts low as well. It's not the same environment. When you talk with people there, you say, we used to be highly respected. And now in modern society, I sometimes think that we've transferred through our television and our media all the negatives of our society out to other world, other countries. But one of those is a lack of respect for the authority of the teacher, for the work of the teacher, and that's part of the challenge that we face. I think too that one of the issues that young people talk about is they had great teachers and some not so great teachers, but they look at the way other students treat teachers. It's not respected in the classroom. Classroom discipline problems come up, and that's why this is not a job they want to do. Any other commenters on that?
Yeah. When I was, I ran for school board in a small town in New England in the late 1960s, and I remember this was in a Route 128 community that was full of engineers, and I went house to house. And it was, more often than not, I would be taken by the father, not the mother, into a room where the father would berate me about the textbooks being used to teach math or science. They were livid. They were livid at the quality of math or science that was represented by the books. They were even more angry at the kind of assignments the kids were getting, which they thought was a travesty of math and science. And I thought to myself, this would almost never have happened 30 or 40 years ago. It's a function of the fact that there are now so many more people better educated than our teachers than was the case 50 years ago or 60 years ago, when teachers who were graduates of normal schools were among the best educated people in the society. Now people coming out of teachers' colleges are looked down by the graduates of almost every other, not quite every other, but almost every other graduate school, if you will, in our universities. They are the low end of the totem pole in the universities, and so consequently in communities that are dominated by professionals that have that kind of education, they are similarly looked down on. What I'm saying is, this is not a matter of public relations. This is not a matter of putting up billboards saying respect your teacher. It's really a matter of what's happened as the as education attainment has evolved in the society as a whole. And so teaching became a profession for first-generation immigrants to aspire to be the first professional. It's not how it started out. And so I honestly think the answer to your question is not entirely yes, as Susan said, but I think money makes a big difference. And I just, you know, for a long time in England, status was a matter of the letters you had in front of your name, or maybe after it. But now, in the United States, it's a matter of money. We recognize status with money in our society. And young people who think they have a shot at Google are not going to take teaching unless they think that they're going to live pretty close to as well. And I think that's a fact. We may or may not like it, but that's how it is.
Michelle?
Hi, Michelle McLaughlin, American Federation of Teachers. I have to say I'm a little surprised by a few things. One, I was surprised in looking at the report that student achievement really isn't talked about much, and I guess that's because the systems in Europe don't really look
no
at that.
No data.
Right. And I was surprised that Sweden got such treatment because it doesn't use, as Howard pointed out, it doesn't use student achievement in its individualized pay system. And then I was surprised to hear Dr. Hess say that the point of pay for performance is not to improve student test scores, because I actually think that's what most politicians think, and most pay for performance systems are being promoted that way. So maybe you want to say a few more words about that?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, remember what I said is really, you know, obviously the reason ultimately that you want to get the kind, you know, however you define good teachers and good administrators, I'm not trying to force any one definition of it here. I'm just saying, you know, generally, if we want to be able to choose from kind of the brightest and most dynamic people in society and then figure out which ones we think should be in schools rather than taking the people who happen to come to us. Mm-hmm. So if that's the aim, obviously you're doing that because in the long run, you think that is going to make for better teaching and learning. And since we all, you know, to some degree, I agree with this notion that good teaching and learning shows up in, you know, kind of the simple achievement test we use. So obviously, in some sense, one of the things we care about long term, in terms of the human capital coming in, is student achievement, right? The idea is that if you are choosing from the kinds of people, if we're getting the chance to choose from the kinds of people we'd like to have the choice from, that over the long haul, we're going to, you know, benefit in kind of the simplistic ways, like, you know, third grade, 3 to 8 reading and math scores. In the short term, though, right, so if you look at, say, the Texas plan, right, so what Texas is now doing, actually, and what's funny is, as Mark was going through examples of what's going on abroad, if you're listening, you realize that almost all of this stuff is being tried somewhere domestically, mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of the nations doing abroad are doing it in, you know, relatively simple-minded ways in a lot of cases, and a lot of what we're doing here is relatively simple-minded, mm-hmm. And what's going to happen, and I'll take serious odds on this conversation, in about 2012 or 2013, we can all go to an international conference where we'll hear about how skill-based or merit-based or group pay-based compensation doesn't work in education because it's been tried domestically, it's been tried abroad, and nobody saw the results they wanted. So let's give up on it and let's go do something else, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, which is where we're heading. And so the answer, of course, is that when you think about, you know, the reason that companies try to aggressively recruit and attract talent and reward outstanding performance and whatnot is not because they figure in their 90-day quarterly reports that if they go out and have a really good recruiting year, that they're then at the end of that quarter going to have better return on investment or higher profitability or something. What they say is the reason you go out and try to get great people and try to keep them in your organization is that you are going to have, as 1 year rolls into the next, a more skilled and higher performing organization over some period of time. When we talk about trying to, you know, whether it was California's kind of trying to reward the schools that had the biggest bump, you know, which rewarded the small schools, the stuff that Kanan Steger talked about, or Texas giving folks who get the, you know, who are hitting some arbitrary threshold, you know, based on SES under the tax achievement, or when we're talking about these kinds of things, one, these aren't the kinds of compensation systems that make smart, dynamic people say, that's a sector I want to be in. That's not what they're geared to. Instead, they're geared to some notion that in the short term, we're going to get people to yield higher achievement because they're going to put a couple more hours in on Sunday night
or they are going to take even more seriously the dictate that they need to cover this material. So one, it's simply not about fattening the human capital pipeline and keeping great people. It's about efforts to use incentives to get short-term bumps in achievement, which isn't the same thing at all as far as I'm concerned. And then the second problem here is that these systems are, you know, these systems simply, you know, we obviously care about boosting achievement in the short term because everybody thinks it's a problem. But the way that you go about doing that isn't by trying to reconfigure a compensation system. Reconfiguring a compensation system is how you increase the quality of the folks in the schools long term. There's different strategies that one needs to use if you're worried about bumping year-over-year achievement. And so what politicians are trying to do is use something which is actually designed to be a long-term solution to transforming the sector to get a happy result in a 9 or 21-month window. And I think it's a problem.
Yes.
Eugenia Kimball, Albert Schenker Institute. You know, the great thing about international studies of this sort is that you have so many variables to deal with that you can almost go for any hypothesis that you want to prove. I'm not accusing anybody, but Mark, and I know you know this from the long term, and in the past you've picked great variables. High skills, low wages back in 90 led the standards movement, really, and was certainly what Al Schenker looked to when he was a leader in that movement. I think there's a piece missing here. I'll try not to make a speech putting it out there. And that has to do with assessment or examinations, which may be in the report, and I have not read it, but I didn't hear it here. Howard had a column up there for core curriculum, and I think that's sort of as close as we got to this, except for all the references for pay for performance. Odd and schema, all three of them, go to student achievement in some part or other. And that's what this is about, just to go back to Michelle's point. And if you're going to do an international comparison that comes up with a set of recommendations or even conclusions, it seems to me that you have to look at what the assessment system is like. The AFT put out a report not so long ago that said that only 13 states really have assessment systems that align with curriculum. I mean, we started this movement in 1990. Mm-hmm. We are 15, 16 years out on this, and we still don't have a system that says what is being taught, what is being assessed, and what that means for accountability. Now, when you go and look at how teachers feel about compensation across these countries, it seems to me you have to be able to say whether you have an examination system where something absolute is getting measured, or whether you have an examination system where kids are being differentiated, or whether you have an examination system that mixes these two and is moving from one to the other. Because who's going to get attracted to teaching? Who's going to stay in it? Who's going to regard the system as fair? Who's going to want their union to bargain for it is going to depend on what that system looks like. And I just think that is so core. So if I were doing an international study and I were picking a variable and I knew that there are no controls really across the whole thing, I'd sure as hell want to look at student assessment.
I know, Mark, you know a lot about this.
I don't know if I know a lot about it. I certainly have a lifelong interest in the question that Jenny just raised. And I am totally in agreement with her. And I think, how do I put this? I want to keep it short. We have an education research paradigm which is based really in clinical psychology. And the idea is to try an intervention and to compare it to what happens when you have other interventions or none at all, assuming there are no changes in the system. And from my point of view, that is about as deeply flawed as a research paradigm can be. Because the issue for us right now is not whether this intervention or that intervention or some other intervention works. The issue in front of all of us right now is what kind of system works best. And you can't answer that question by changing one little piece of it and seeing what happens. And so what we've been doing, I think Ginny recapped it exactly right, what we've been doing is trying a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And actually, you said the same thing. So we try it, and it failed. Well, no, it didn't fail. We actually never tried it, because it only stands a chance of working in the context of a different system, right? Which we don't put in place. So, coming back to your point, if you want to attract the best of our young people to schools, they have to be exciting places to work. They have to be intellectually vibrant. They have to have a curriculum that makes sense to the people who are teaching. It has to be tested in a way that makes sense to them. The rewards that they get have to be related to all of that. You have to design a system. You can't just try a series of interventions, which is exactly what we have been doing. It's the difference between trying an intervention and doing a paradigm shift. And I think Americans are, this is a comment I frequently get from people, friends I have abroad who look back at our system. They don't understand how it is that we can be so, they don't understand how it is possible for us to operate this education system without seeing it as a system. They see us as being incapable of approaching systemic change in this country. They see us trying a series of interventions, and it's obvious to them they're not working, and they wonder when we're going to smarten up. I don't know whether any of you had the same experience in talking to people abroad, but I get this over and over and over again, and I take that to be at the root, Ginny, of what you were saying.
Very interesting. Any other questions or comments? Susan?
At the risk of talking about an intervention versus systemic reform, it seems that we're missing the conversation about induction, about what we do with teachers when we hit our buildings, no matter what pre-service they've had, whether it's alternative certification or schools of education. And if we really are going to invest in long-term teaching, we, as Lou Gerstner said, do a very, very poor job of it. He said a couple years ago, I think if he did the same thing to his IBM employees, which is essentially dump them into IBM installations and let's say go for it without any other investment in training, he would lose about 50% of or more of his employees in 5 years also, which would be an investment he could not afford to lose. So what are, if anything, are other countries doing in terms of real induction, real quality induction, and how does that fit into the conversation, Mark, about systemic reform in this area?
Yeah, we were trying to limit this, and I would really recommend that you look at Teachers Matter, the report of the OECD, because it focuses on induction as well as in-service, pre-service training, and it gives you the whole picture. We were just trying to look at a little piece of this, but clearly other countries do it differently. Other countries require a whole lot more before teachers are ever placed in the classroom, and then have different mentors. Singapore, for example, has a system in which they, as Mark said, choose people out of the top third of the high school graduating class, send them to their colleges of education, mentor them for their first 5 years within the school, giving them increasing responsibilities and opportunities for leadership. And then as they find demonstrated leadership, they pull them out, send them to their leadership training programs, bring them back, place them with an outstanding mentor principal for a year before they're ever asked to be an administrator themselves. So clearly there are very different models for doing this, and you get that kind of integration and coherence when you do all of those pieces. In other cases, in Germany, for example, it's very hard to become a teacher. There are exams to get in, there's exams to get out to become a teacher, but then there's no evaluation from that point forward. So the systems are very different, and I really would encourage you to look at the OECD paper. But I also think that, again, we keep saying it's the whole system you have to look at. We were just highlighting some of the pieces on compensation here that people could look at. And in the back of the book, that's what the appendix is for, to give you more detail about the system and how they might go about doing it.
Could I raise something here?
Yeah.
Not to be combative, Susan, but make this a little more exciting. Which side are you on here? The outstanding pay for new young workers to get them into the profession, or the intensive training, long induction period to keep them there for a long time?
Well, I think you need to start them at a salary that will draw them into the profession if we want to get these people who have lots of other options. But then I believe that, of course, you want to have an induction process that enables them to grow. Some countries, for example, require fewer courses taught by the new teachers to give them a chance to not only improve their practice, have more time to plan, but also to observe master teachers in their school. So I want both. I don't want it one or the other. I want us to get smart young people who have other options to come into teaching, and I want us to support them so that they want to stay in teaching. I want our principals to be people who are well prepared so that they create environments that teachers want to stay in. And then I think that, you know, some will leave, some will stay. But it's not an either or. If we want a vibrant system, we've got to put all of the pieces in place.
All right, one more question from Kate. Even though this is the last question.
Keep it short.
That's okay. I don't think anybody's going to know the answer. I'll try. Kate Walsh with the National Council on Teacher Quality. I just was wondering if you, and I was flipping through here trying to find something on teacher pensions, and if you saw any differences across countries and sort of how the pension systems are structured.
In most countries, the pensions are structured very much as ours are. I didn't spend a lot of time detailing those in the report because they were so similar. And again, it was one of the factors that many countries took into account when they looked at the competitiveness of their salaries, to say when you compare the number of vacation days, when you compare the pension system, then the system is equivalent to private sector opportunities. But they're mainly very similar to ours. Work for 30 years and you're set for life.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, panelists, for...
One more thing. I just want to acknowledge Kirti Hasija, who's in our audience here. She's one of the people who did the research with me on this paper. We had others at Chartwell who did it as well. But I do want to recognize that the voluminous research that went into this, and you can tell by looking at the bibliography, was gathered in part by our staff, and then I tried to put it together.
Yes, thank you, Gert. And thank all of you. Look, this is a conversation we have to keep having. In many ways, this discussion this morning is very sobering. We have a long way to go if we're going to figure out how to strengthen teacher quality in this country, pay people well to attract the kind of folks we need. This notion of system that Mark talked to us about is so important, and I hope this study will sort of stimulate interest in more research and study about what those countries that are having some success are doing, although I guess the final message of this is that they're struggling with these issues as well. Thank you very much. I learned a lot, actually, from this discussion this morning, and I hope all of you did, too. Thank you.